The third case for oral argument this morning is Stephen Holman Appellant versus William Mudhanky Appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. Richard Russman, an attorney from Aberdeen, and for the appellee, we have Mr. Greg Peterson, an attorney also from Aberdeen. Mr. Russman, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. Please, the court, counsel.
I'm sure the court is aware of the basic fact pattern that's involved here. I'd like to sort of develop additional facts as we go along, but essentially what this case was about was my client, Steve Holm, and an associate of his, Bill Mudhanky, initially hatched a plan to start a trash hauling business. And that business grew steadily over the next 17 years or so. It was our contention at trial that Bill Mudhanky had basically removed himself, if he ever was a partner, from any putative partnership early in the 90s, in fact, 1990. I believe in 2007, Mr. Mudhanky brought an action, wanting a piece of this business, obviously. His action was technically for an accounting. We requested it, and after an accounting, he wanted to be awarded essentially damages or a judgment in an amount equal to his share of the value of the business. We answered the complaint and requested a jury trial. In fact, the plaintiff, Mr. Mudhanky, initially demanded a jury trial as well. As the case went along, it was clear that the plaintiff's attorney and I disagreed about whether or not I was entitled to a jury trial, so I made a motion for a jury trial. That jury trial was ultimately denied. And that's the first issue that I want to address with the court, the denial of the motion for the jury trial. In doing so, we have to start, I think, with the proposition that it is guaranteed to both litigants in Article 6, Section 6 of the South Dakota State Constitution and SDCL 15-6-38A and B, a jury trial. That right doesn't exist in all cases, however, and in cases that sound purely in equity, that right doesn't exist. It was the allegation of the plaintiff that this was an action purely in equity, and therefore that right did not exist. We believe otherwise. The first thing that we need to do then is determine whether this was in fact an action in equity or law. We submit that it was an action at both equity and law for several different reasons. First of all, the complaint, although framed in terms of as a action for an accounting, was in essence an action for damages. The plaintiff wanted an accounting, but he also wanted the court to award him a judgment at the conclusion of the accounting. We, of course, denied the existence of a partnership, and we said that that factual issue was ripe for determination by a jury. The reason why I think that this is an action both in equity and at law is because, as I said before, they were asking for damages. I think that that lends itself to being an action for law. But also because this case could have been brought either as an action for an accounting or a standard breach of contract case, which would obviously be, they didn't do that. They chose a certain procedure, but another procedure could have been chosen, and that would have been a standard breach of contract action, at which point it would obviously be an action at law, at which point we'd obviously be entitled to a trial by jury.
So did the original pleadings by the plaintiff create a question of law, or did the response to it?
I think the original pleadings created an action at law, because not only did they want the accounting, they wanted the attenuant damages or judgment that went along with that.
But does it matter whether it's the complaint or the answer that creates the issue of law?
I don't think it does. I think that if you wouldn't find that the complaint created the issue at law, the answer certainly would have, because we denied the existence of the partnership. What we said is that essentially that factual issue is absolutely essential to the later determination of the issue of whether or not the accounting should be awarded and ultimately damages.
It's not quite that simple, though, just calling it an accounting.
as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, the actual pleading was for an accounting, a settlement of the partnership, and for dissolution.
As well as damages, yes.
So, I mean, when you add all those things together, doesn't it start looking more equitable than legal when you're also asking for settlement and dissolution?
Well, I think that those requests are equitable, but you've got to attenuate with that. You've got this legal claim for the damages. And then, as we talked about earlier, I think that the answer that was provided also created an action at law.
Well, don't you muddy the waters a little further by coming with the counter-argument, there never was a partnership to begin with. Don't you have to initially decide that before you go to all these other issues?
I think you do, and I think that that was an issue of fact to which should have been submitted to a jury.
What's the difference between the request for settlement of the partnership and what you call a request for damages? Aren't they the same thing?
I think they are the same thing.
With different names.
With different names, yes. The second reason I think that this was an action at law is the issue of the existence of the partnership and the factors that were relevant at the time of the existence of this business entity, whatever it was governed by South Dakota law that has been since repealed. That was formerly SDCL 48-1-5 through 48-1-8. I think because the legislature has spoken on this issue, that again creates an action at law.
Well, legislature's spoken on divorce, and that doesn't make that an action at law, does it?
Well, but I think what the legislature has stated is that that is purely an equitable claim. To the extent that the appellee has argued that the existence of a partnership is merely, this is an argument that was made in their brief, that the existence of the partnership was merely incidental to their otherwise equitable claim. I want to talk about that for a minute. I don't think that this argument holds any water anymore in light of the United States Supreme Court of Dairy Queen Inc. v. Wood. It's a very similar case. They weren't requesting an account. Well, they were requesting an accounting, but they were also requesting the Dairy Queen franchise was requesting, I believe, in addition to an accounting, I think they wanted some sort of they wanted to prevent the franchisee from continuing to operate, and they also wanted damages. Supreme Court talked about this, and the Supreme Court said point blank that they were removing any indication that the person requesting a jury trial would have to prove that the declaratory relief or the factual issue giving rise to the declaratory relief was other than incidental. The appellee has argued that the declaratory relief, or in other words, the declaration of whether or not a partnership existed here was merely incidental. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter in light of Dairy Queen v. Wood, and this court has recognized that principle in National Bank of Philip v. Temple at footnote 2. The second basis for, I think, the existence of a right for the jury trial is found in SDCL 21-24-9, which provides for a jury trial in declaratory actions regarding issues of fact.
Doesn't it say may?
It does say may. I'd like to address that at this time, for please the court.
Sure.
I think that that language, the way I read it, in connection with the entire language here, the entire language is when a proceeding under this chapter involves the determination of an issue of fact, such issue may be tried and determined in the same manner as issues of fact are tried and determined in other civil actions. But I think that that language may involves is not the discretion of the trial court to grant the jury trial. I think that if a declaratory judgment action or declaratory relief includes a question of fact, that a litigant is absolutely entitled to a jury trial as to that question of fact. In this case, the question of fact was the existence of a partnership. I think that may language talks about the choices that the litigants have. In other words, they may request a jury trial or they may request a trial to the court. That's my interpretation of that may language. I guess in closing on the issue of the jury trial, because the appellee's claim necessarily required a declaration of the legal status of these parties, and that was a purely factual issue. The court can see that from the trial court's memorandum decision. That's all it was, is it was a weighing of factual dispute. And this declaration, in essence, is what it was part and parcel of their prayer for relief. It was essential to their prayer for relief. It was a prerequisite to their prayer for relief. I think that that factual issue under the law should have been submitted to a jury. And likewise, I think it should have been submitted to the jury because I believe that at core, the appellee's claim at the beginning, from the very start, when it asked for what amounted to damages via a judgment, was a legal issue. That's all I have on that issue number one.
Would that take us to the point, though, that anytime there's any monetary impact in an equitable action, you're going to have a jury trial?
I think what the court is referring to is the trial court statement that this would create an absurd result, for example, when anyone requests an accounting in the context of a partnership situation. And I don't think that that's the right way to look at it, because most cases involving a partnership and an accounting, there's not going to be a dispute as to whether there's a partnership in existence. The majority of the cases probably involve a written partnership agreement, or if they don't involve a written partnership agreement, the parties generally, I don't think, are going to be fighting about the existence of a partnership. I'm saying that in those cases where a plaintiff requests an accounting and the existence of the partnership is an issue, that's a factual issue that should be determined by a jury. And I think that to deny that request is to deny an essential right under the South Dakota State Constitution. Issue number two was, did the trial court err in its determination that the parties were partners, or erred when it determined that there was not a de facto dissolution of the partnership subsequent to the formation? Appellee's primary argument at trial, this again goes back to all of these facts that the court had to determine, and again kind of in a roundabout way I think proves the point that this should have been determined by a jury. But their primary argument at trial is that my client and Mr. Mudhanky talked about themselves in terms of being partners, which was true. Third parties believed they were partners. That was true. My argument at trial and my argument to this court is that what people call themselves, lay people call themselves, in the context of a legal relationship is of far less importance than how the business actually operates. In the context of a third-party claim for detrimental reliance, for example, on the involving the existence of a partnership, I think that that issue is much more important and much more indicative of a partnership. But I think it's more important here to look at how this business actually operated. And this business did not operate as a partnership. The court, I think, essentially ignored the most important facts that one would tend to look at in order to determine whether or not a partnership existed. The most important, I think, is the evidence presented in the tax returns. This entity was categorized for IRS tax purposes as a sole proprietorship in the name of Steve Holm. No partnership return was ever filed. No taxes were ever paid on any income by Mr. Mudhanky, only Mr. Holm. Mr. Mudhanky never took any losses for tax purposes in years where they lost money. So I think that's extremely important. The trial court seems to ignore the fact that Mr. Mudhanky was never paid, never derived any income from the business as a partner generally would. At times, Mr. Mudhank, when he was around, would do what I would categorize as odd jobs. When he did, he was always paid as either an independent contractor or as an employee. So I think that that militates against the existence of a partnership. The trial court, at least in its memorandum decision, seems to have ignored the fact that way back in 1990, after the business had been operating for a very short period of time, was not showing any kind of a profit, didn't show a lot of potential, Mr. Munhenke told my client that he no longer wanted to be involved in the day-to-day operations of the business, which was contrary to the whatever agreement that they had about the partnership. They were going to share the work, they were going to share the profits. Mr. Munhenke, as far back as 1990, says, I don't want to be involved in these day-to-day operations.
So are you conceding at one point there was an original agreement of a partnership?
Well, I think at some point I have to concede that. But my argument is that there was a de facto dissolution back in 1990 when the arrangement changed.
When Munhenke steps back and says, I'm going to Arizona for the winter,
right.
That's when it ends, in your opinion?
That's my opinion, yes.
All right.
And Mr. Munhenke did come back from time to time. I think that my client was he was a neophyte in business at that point. I don't think he knew what his legal relationship was with Mr. Munhenke. I think Mr. Munhenke somewhat took advantage and came and cherry-picked opportunities. For example, at one point in time, Mr. Munhenke encouraged my client to accept the Brown County grass and leaves disposal contract. My client didn't want to do it. He wasn't equipped to do it. It was a job that he just didn't want to do. Mr. Munhenke convinced him to bid it on the agreement that Mr. Munhenke would do all the work in connection with it personally. Well, he did some of the work, and he was paid for everything that he did independently as an independent contractor. To me, that smacks of something other than a partnership. Other examples that I think that the trial court ignored were Mr. Munhenke acted in derogation, I think, of the idea that there was any partnership. One glaring example was that the business was going to move to a larger location. Mr. Munhenke had previously had this business in sort of a warehouse type area along with his other business concerns and allowed Steve to work out of there. He encouraged Steve to find a bigger and better location. They looked at a place. Steve was interested in the place. He told Mr. Munhenke he was interested and was going to go to the bank to look for financing. The very next day, Mr. Munhenke told Steve, don't bother, I bought it. Mr. Munhenke then essentially had a building and a captive tenant. He charged the tenant, that was Steve, rent, and I think Steve felt very undercut by that decision, and I think it was in derogation of the partnership, of any putative partnership.
Now, how many of these facts were actually in dispute then that the judge would have found as fact?
You know, I don't think there was a great deal of disagreement concerning the individual facts that came out. In other words, I don't recall getting into a lengthy cross-examination where I would dispute what Mr. Munhenke said or their witnesses said.
I guess where I'm getting at is, are we looking at a clearly erroneous finding of fact, or are we looking at, based on these facts, a incorrect conclusion of law?
I think you could categorize it as the latter, yes.
But even based on the facts as the judge found them, assuming you get back or you lose on the jury trial thing, that we could say as a matter of law that this was not a partnership.
I think you could.
And that's what you're asking this court to do.
I am. And I think unless the court has any other questions, she has sort of provided my conclusion.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Russell.
Thank you.
Mr. Peterson, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. I think it's helpful when we start a presentation like this to look at the big picture.
And in looking at the big picture, I think we need to look at the context of the relationship between these two men. This case is about two men, one of whom was an entrepreneur. In the appellant's brief, he was referred to as an opportunist. And frankly, I wouldn't take issue with that in this sense. Bill Mudhank came to Aberdeen, South Dakota in the 1970s. His dad discontinued a fleet operation of petroleum fuel carriers, turned over the individual terminals to individuals, one of whom was his son, Bill Mudhank. Bill moved to Aberdeen, ran a couple of trucks off of a telephone pole where he could plug a line in and take orders, and grew that business, unrelated to this transaction, of course, into enough of a business that he was able to purchase property on the east side of Aberdeen, took on a partner, in actually developed a second trucking business because the petroleum fuel business was only one thing he could do. He had another opportunity to develop another trucking company, trucking grain into Minneapolis and bringing parts back to Hub City, one of the industries that we have in Aberdeen. Brought in a fellow by the name of Terry Boyle, who started a machining shop and was a partner with Bill Mudhank in that. And along about this time in the history of Bill Mudhank and his introduction into business in Aberdeen, he hears of a mechanic working at a local car dealership who is having a hard time, in his own words, making any money. Brings him over, offers him some position, offers him some compensation. They become good friends. At that time, Mr. Holm was going through a divorce. He was virtually penniless. And he was also, because of the divorce, homeless. A couple of incidental businesses. There was an arcade that was developed in which Mr. Holm was a partner with Mr. Mudhank and with Mr. Boyle. There was also another business that, one of the trucking businesses that Mr. Holm and Mr. Mudhank were partners in. Mr. Mudhank learns that there's only one real garbage hauling service in Aberdeen, except that his brother-in-law started up a competitive business. His brother-in-law, within a very short period of time, sold out to the one existing garbage business in Aberdeen, Dependable Sanitation. My client sees another opportunity, and he says to Mr. Holm, and he says to Mr. Boyle, would you gentlemen be interested in starting a garbage hauling business with me? Now, the plan had two objectives. One was, if it gets built up and it's successful, it gives us some money from our day-to-day operations. Ultimately, they knew it wouldn't as a fledgling company. Secondly, we can build this into a big enough piece of competition that Dependable Sanitation may come in and buy us, and if not, somebody at some point in time is going to buy it. It's going to be a good opportunity for me to develop a retirement plan. That, in a 4-minute, 3.5-minute nutshell, is the genesis of A1 Sanitation. And there isn't any question, when you look at the facts and the witnesses who testified about A1 Sanitation, that it clearly was started as a partnership. Unfortunately, and in my client's own words, it wasn't his finest hour when he developed it the way that he did. Somebody was asking me about this case, and they said, so what was the business model? And I said, they would have at least had a napkin, because it was put together as an oral agreement among three friends, and it worked pretty well.
But what you're saying is compelling, but why shouldn't that be argued to a jury, whether there was a partnership or not?
Well, the question of whether or not there was a partnership, which of course was put into dispute by the defendant when he answered the complaint, was incidental to a core proceeding, which is an equitable proceeding.
Well, the incidental rule we don't use anymore. The United States Supreme Court has spoken on that. A person is entitled to a jury trial as to all issues triable at law, all issues. And we said back almost 20 years ago that the incidental rule doesn't apply. If it's a issue of law, a person is entitled to a jury trial on it.
But the existence of a partnership is a question of fact, to be determined by the fact finder. And the core proceeding is still a dissolution and accounting proceeding of a partnership.
But isn't
that presumes it? I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Please.
Isn't it still then a conclusion of law on whether or not the partnership existed? It's got to be. I don't see how it's a finding of fact. I think the facts, whether the, under the facts, however the jury or the court finds them, is a conclusion of law on whether or not it's a partnership.
Isn't the finding of fact for the trier of fact, and isn't the question of whether the trier of fact is a judge or a jury a matter of whether it's an equitable proceeding or a legal proceeding? And isn't, and I'm asking these questions in a rhetorical way because the cases that we cited in our brief answer these questions yes, isn't the dissolution of a partnership in the accounting, that is to say, the accounting, let's talk about that just momentarily. Let's look at each of the years of the partnership and let's look at what the profits were, let's look at what the losses were, let's look at what the income was, what the expenses were, let's look at what the overhead was, and let's look at what each of the individual partners had coming to them for each of those years. That's the core proceeding that we're faced with here.
But doesn't the underlying question have to be decided first, which is a question of law on whether or not it's a partnership under the facts of the case? How can you dissolve it if it doesn't exist?
That's clearly a true statement. How can you dissolve it if it doesn't exist? But I still don't see that that is a question of law. I see that that's part and parcel of the equitable question of the dissolution, whether or not the partners are entitled to seek dissolution and seek an accounting. We have some answers in a couple of other court cases, Your Honors, and the trial court relied on a Missouri Court of Appeals case for this exact proposition that the existence of a partnership was a question for the trial court. Actually, I'm going to quote from that case, if I may. An action for an accounting is an equitable action, and any partner shall have the right to a formal account as to the partnership affairs. Logically, before the trial court could order an accounting under this portion of the section, it would have to first determine that the partnership did in fact exist if that dispute was in error, if that issue was in dispute as it is here. The determination of the existence of the partnership in a suit for accounting is part and parcel of the equitable proceeding. It is a vital part of the equitable proceeding. This determination would be made by the trial court with no right to a jury trial as claimed by Lofgren. With respect to the Dairy Queen case that Mr. Russman referenced, that case was based upon the federal counterpart to Rule 18B of our Rules of Civil Procedure. That rule indicates that the two claims, when we have a legal claim and an equitable claim, may be joined in a single action, and that the court shall grant relief in that action only in accordance with the relative substantive rights of the parties. I would also submit that the issue of the jury trial would depend in part on whether or not we can bifurcate these legal claims from these equitable claims. Mr. Russman referenced the fact that there's a claim for damages, and the inquiry from the court was whether or not a claim for an accounting and the corresponding amount that may be due from one partner to the other, is that tantamount to a claim for damages? Again, following the guidelines that this court has previously given us on equitable actions and accounting, I would submit that the questions are entirely equitable, that does not transform or transmogrify our complaint into a legal claim. But if it does, and we did have a claim for punitive damages, which is clearly a claim at law, the court can bifurcate those claims. In the Durkee case and in the Berks, I won't say Berkside, but I don't think I'm saying that quite right. We clearly have a couple of Supreme Court cases that Brookside Townhouse Association that clearly did allow for that bifurcation, and we have before the court, before the trial court, that is, a matter that was not formally ruled upon, but it resulted in an informal agreement to bifurcate this question of the existence of a partnership from the question of the accounting and the dissolution. And then I think we actually have a third, if you will, a trifurcation, where if we get through those first two hurdles, then we'll be able to move on to the question of damages and whether or not there's even a claim. Secondly, there's a question, if we had brought this claim as a direct cause of action for fraud or for other causes of action of a similar nature against Mr. Holm, we may have been able to pursue that action directly at law, bypassing the accounting and dissolution. That comes to us from the Muncie case, which was decided quite a few years ago by this court. I think there's at least room to argue whether or not we have to first go to the accounting and dissolution based upon the Muncie case, which quoted the Ellenbecker case. And then we get to the second cause of action dealing with damages. So I think we deal with the question of jury trial first by just allowing us to do the accounting and dissolution as the trial court has ruled, number one, and number two, then proceed to the action at law, which probably would include a jury trial.
So what is the action at law that you are talking about now?
Well, we have a claim in our complaint for punitive damages.
Punitive damages.
Right. And that's...
So if you're asking for a jury trial of punitive damages, so what... I mean, if we say you have a jury trial on the partnership, let's say, you lose that issue, then what happens then? How would it work then?
Well, first of all, if we lose a jury trial on the issue of partnership, I'm not sure that my client would have any standing to proceed.
Right. But would the damages actually be presented at that time, or would you have two jury trials? I guess that was my question.
Well, if you look at Durkee and Brookside, I think the answer is we can clearly bifurcate those, put the equitable claims to the trial court, which is our intent, and put the legal claims to a jury.
And the equitable is the accounting.
Correct.
And the dissolution.
Correct. And I think that's the kind of intensive thing. The reason that that's an equitable claim tried to a court is if you think about the intensity of the issues that are going on in accounting, I think we need to adjust those before we even get to whether there's any other claims. And secondly, any other claims may be absorbed, as the court cases have held, into the equitable claim. Just simply resulting in what is an appropriate division of profits and what is an appropriate division of equity in this case. Now, jump forward.
So let me just, so I understand. You said there was an agreement that at least a part of it would have to be tried to a jury, a part of your claim.
First of all, we've asked the court to bifurcate those two claims. And that's not been ruled on because we informally agreed to first try the question of the existence of a partnership.
Okay.
So the answer is yes. If I need to get to that third level, establish a partnership, adjust the accounting, and go to that third level, then I believe that's an action at law that will be tried to a jury.
And was the trial court aware of that agreement?
Yes, it was. I can prove that by two reasons. First of all, we do have a pretrial checklist as part of the settled record where that issue was brought up. I gave some written comments to that, number one. Number two, the informal agreement, and the only, as far as I can go on the informal agreement, is as to the issue of trying the existence of a partnership first before we even get to the dissolution and accounting. And the court identifies that in its memorandum decision, says the issues for trial before the court are the existence of a partnership and whether or not there's been a de facto dissolution.
And that's the only decisions that have been made in this case so far.
That's right? Correct. That's correct. With the amount of time that I have left, let me go to a concession that was made at oral argument, which I believe is the first time that this concession was made. Mr. Russman, if I understood and heard his words correctly, said at some point in time I have to concede that there was a partnership at the inception. If there was not disputed facts, and I did move for summary judgment, and summary judgment was denied because the court ruled back then that there was a material issue of fact or a genuine issue of a material fact, we have replete in our briefs, as we did, we had countering testimony, one party saying one thing, one party saying the other. Trial court did clearly have to adjust those facts and determine those facts. In the absence of finding by this court that there's not substantial evidence in the record to support those or that those findings are clearly erroneous, that decision should prevail, number one. Number two, when Mr. Russman says at some point in time, I have to concede that there was a partnership at some point in the existence of A1 Sanitation, we now have an agreement among the parties that there was a partnership. It was a partnership at will. It had no definite term. And by the rules that we've established in our case law as well as in the old statutory scheme that we're operating under for this partnership, that partnership continued until there was an affirmative act of dissolution. And I've quoted, as well as the trial court did, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals case, Nelson versus Seaboard Surety Company, that talks about, I'm crossing some cases. We had a different case that the trial court and we submitted in our brief that talked about what it requires to show that there is an affirmative, unequivocal dissolution of the partnership, and the law is clear that there must be an unequivocal affirmative act of notifying the other party of the intent to dissolve.
Now, did the trial court make a finding on that?
It did, and it said that there was no affirmative, unequivocal act of an intent to dissolve. But let's make that more pointed. If the conversation occurred, as Mr. Holm testified, that in December of 1990, my client said, I want to change the roles of the parties here. I want to step back from the day-to-day operations, and I want you to start taking things over. Now, we have a difference of opinion as to whether that occurred in 1990 or whether it occurred in 1994, simultaneous or contemporaneous to the time that the parties moved A1 Sanitation from the east side of Aberdeen down into basically the center of town. At a previous industrial site. There were a number of things that Mr. Holm complains about, but he admitted at trial that after none of these events occurred, did he make an affirmative act of telling Mr. Mudhank he wanted to dissolve, we're done, or anything like that. Now, when Mr. Boyle, who was only involved in the first 6 months of A1 Sanitation, wasn't carrying his share of the weight, Bill Mudhank went to him and said, what's up? You're not driving the truck as much as we are. You're not soliciting accounts. He says, I didn't get into this business to drive a garbage truck. Bill Mudhank says, well, then you're done. And he says, you bet, I'm done. That's an affirmative, unequivocal act of two partners dissolving the partnership. Mr. Holm complains about Mr. Mudhank buying the 9th Avenue property out from under him in 1994. But if, in fact, that's a complaint, did he go to Mr. Mudhank and say, we're done? No. In fact, Mr. Mudhank subsidized the rent that was due on that property. When Bill Mudhank and Steve Holm were named as defendants in a lawsuit in 1991, did Steve Holm take that opportunity, since he'd had this December 1990 conversation, to tell his lawyer, oh, by the way, get Bill Mudhank out of this because he's not a partner anymore? No. In 1998, when they turned the tables on this same party, one of their former truck drivers, and said, we think you should no longer be able to compete with us based upon the agreement that we hired you on, he started up his own independent company, Cleanup Sanitation. Mr. Holm goes to Tom Tonner and says, name Bill Mudhank and name me as defendants or plaintiffs of A1 Sanitation to shut this guy down and get a court injunction. So that's clearly counter to this, quote, unequivocal act of letting somebody know that we want to dissolve a partnership. And then finally we get to the negotiations to sell A1 Sanitation. We've got two sets of negotiations over two different time periods with Dependable. And Mr. Mudhank is involved in this. Mr. Holm is involved in this. At no point in time does Mr. Holm say to Mr. Mudhank or to either Mr. Mudhank or to Dependable Sanitation, you don't need to deal with him. He has no interest in this.
I have a question on that. Factually, when Mr. Erickson is talking to Holm and Mudhank, apparently some of the conversations are just one-on-one.
True.
All right. Did Holm and Mudhank know that Erickson was talking to the other person individually?
I'd have to go back and find the exact reference to the record, but, Judge, I believe that they both knew that the other was talking to Dependable. It was kind of a tri-conversation. Occasionally, Mudhank and Holm both with Erickson, occasionally Mud Hank with Erickson, occasionally Holm with Erickson.
Was there any objection by Holm? Why are you talking to Mud Hank? He's not a player anyway.
No.
Okay. I think I just ran you out of time.
That's fine, Your Honor. Do I have time for a concluding thought then or no?
One or two sentences.
All right. Simply this. If these two folks weren't partners, then why would Bill Mudhank do all of the things that we've referenced in our briefs to facilitate the operation of A1 Sanitation? For those reasons, for the standard of review reasons that we really haven't even talked about, I'd ask this court to affirm the trial court.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Russman, you have 10 minutes.
Okay. I'd like to start by answering Mr. Peterson's last question. The reason why Bill Mudhank was involved to the extent he was is because it was an opportunity to cherry-pick opportunities and take advantage of his friend. He would step in occasionally and accept some benefits as though he were a partner, but he never proceeded as a partner.
Let me ask you, if you conceded that there was a, and if you didn't mean to concede, then indicate that, but I thought, too, that you conceded that at some point, at least at the inception, there was a partnership.
I would like to rephrase that if I could. I think what we had was an agreement to form a partnership, but almost from inception, it did not operate as a partnership. Maybe.
Okay, so you are withdrawing that.
I would. I think that there was a meeting of the minds as to what might occur in the future, but it almost from inception never operated like that, and it certainly didn't operate that way when Mr. Mudhank came to my client and said, the things that we talked about before, share the works, share the profit, that's off. I don't want anything to do with this.
Are you conceding there was a partnership during the 6 months that Boyle was involved?
Do I have to? I don't know.
We're not going to order it.
I would say that it resembled a partnership for that very short period of time.
Kind of, sort of, huh?
Kind of, sort of, yeah.
Well, let me ask, that gets to my, if there's a concession or if the facts indicate that at least at some point in time there was a partnership, that's sort of an undisputed facts that are create the partnership, then is the dispute then on when the dissolution actually occurred?
I would say so.
Because the judge finds it was, what, summer of 2005?
Right.
And at least you would dispute that it was earlier than that. If there was a dissolution, it had to be earlier than that.
I would say that it was in 1990.
Okay. So then my question is the dissolution part of it, and when it occurred, an equitable decision that the judge needs to make?
I think it's still a factual determination. And I think that that is right for the jury's determination.
Just because it's a question of fact doesn't make it a jury call. I mean, all the questions of fact aren't decided by a jury. There's questions of fact in equitable claims. So you can't just answer the question by saying it's a question of fact.
I would agree with that statement. What I'm saying is it is essentially a request for a declaration from the judge as to the legal, or a declaration from the finder of fact as to the legal relationship of these parties. And under statute, I think that my client would then be entitled to a jury trial on that question of fact.
How do you distinguish that the Missouri case, Mayer versus Loughran?
I'd like to do that. First of all, Mayer v. Loughran, the Missouri court obviously recognized the incidental rule because they quoted that. That was the reason for the decision that they made, that the determination of the existence of a partnership was merely incidental to an otherwise equitable claim. That's the reason they did that. They obviously do not recognize the Dairy Queen case. And beyond that, I would say it's not binding and it's a not good law. But how you distinguish it, I think, is on that basis, because this court has clearly rejected the incidental rule via its decision in First National Bank of Philip. And I think that case is interesting, too, because it kind of leads us, I think, in the right direction here. I don't remember all the facts of First National Bank v. Philip, but I remember that the plaintiff requested declaratory relief regarding the rights and responsibilities vis-a-vis some sort of a cattle contract. And the court in that case went into a long discussion about how we determine whether claims are equitable or they're at law. And in that case, they said one of the ways, or the way that they were going to look at this, is if this action could have been brought via another format. For example, could this be brought, for example, in my case, I use the example, this could have been brought as a breach of contract as opposed to an action for accounting. In that case, they said the only other way that this could have been brought, that is in First National Bank, is via an action for foreclosure, which is obviously equitable, and therefore we don't have any legal claims. If there was another way to bring this action, then you might have a legal claim. So I think that case kind of brings us or takes us in the right direction.
Bringing a breach of contract, are you saying what's the contract? Whether or not there's a partnership in contract? And if you do that, my second part of that is, all right, then what's the damages if it doesn't require an accounting to determine the breach?
I think I understand the question.
Well, I hope I understand it.
Okay. What I'm saying here is that if the plaintiff had so chosen, he wouldn't have had to request an accounting. He simply would have had to allege that the parties had a contract, and that contract was to be partners in this business, that my client was denying him his rights under the contract, that is to the profits, etc., and sued him for damages in connection with that alleged breach. I think that could have been done that simply. And just because they didn't use the magic words breach of contract, but rather accounting, I don't think that it's correct to deny the defendant the right to a jury trial. I want to address one additional item here, because the appellee is hanging his hat completely when it comes to the issue of whether a partnership did in fact exist and whether the court's determination on that issue was correct. Mr. Peterson hangs his hat, I think, completely on the unequivocal intent to dissolve the corporation. In other words, again, my client didn't say the magic words. Well, I would assert to the court that Mr. Mudhank said the magic words back in 1990 when he informed my client that, you know, that original agreement we had, we're not doing that anymore, I'm not doing that anymore. I think that was the unequivocal dissolution when he changed the rules. From that point, he was involved simply to cherry-pick some opportunities. I think that was the unequivocal intention not to persist as a partnership.
But what about the lawsuit well after that where Mudhanky and Holm sue out as plaintiffs? Isn't that virtually a judicial stipulation that they're a partnership?
I have not reread the record recently. I don't recall that testimony. I'm not sure it's in the record. I do recall.